Far-right reform UK benefits from the electoral collapse of Britain's Labour Party. What way forward for the working class? Britain's Scottish and Welsh Parliament and UK local council elections have marked a deepening in the collapse of the Labour Party. Having long ago lost power in Scotland, historically a stronghold for Labour, it has now been wiped out in the devolved Welsh Senedd, where it has been the ruling party since the Senedd's creation 27 years ago. Labour fell from 30 out of 60 seats to 9 out of a newly expanded 98-seat parliament. In local council elections across the UK, the party lost close to 1,000 seats out of roughly 2,250. At the time of writing, it was losing 4 out of every 5 seats, where it previously held a 5 to 10% majority, and 1 in every 2, where its majority had been higher than 30%. Among the lost councils were multiple major cities with long Labour histories: Birmingham, Sunderland, Hartlepool, and Leeds. Manchester and Wigan would have fallen too if all their seats had been up for election this year. Not only do the vast majority of workers see no reason to cast a ballot for Labour, most actively despise it. They were promised change from the Tories and have received more of the same. The faces are new, but they speak the same lines: austerity in the interests of the bond markets, fiscal discipline, and financial headroom. More military spending for the war in Ukraine, to carve out a niche amid the ongoing U.S.-led war in Iran, and to reinforce Britain's support for Israel. Among young people and Britain's Muslim population in particular, Labour will never be forgiven for its complicity in the Gaza genocide, reflected in gains for the Green Party, especially in the capital London. But by far the biggest beneficiary of Labour's collapse is Nigel Farage's far-right Reform UK. The party took 34 seats in the Welsh Senedd and gained over 1,000 councillors across the UK. According to analysis from Sky News, the vote suggests Reform would win 27% of a national vote, close to double the 14% it received in the 2024 general election. The Conservatives, the traditional party of the British right, would come second with 20% and Labour third with 15%. Less than half its 34% share in 2024. The Greens would receive 13%. That a party characterized above all by its attacks on welfare recipients and migrants, led by a multimillionaire former stockbroker and advocate of privatizing the NHS, is leading the polls in Britain, with its support concentrated in more working-class constituencies, is a devastating indictment of what has passed for the left. Labour has been hemorrhaging support since Tony Blair, but what has really given Reform its head is the repeated sabotage of the striving by workers for a left-wing alternative. More than anyone else, the man who bears responsibility for Reform's rise is Jeremy Corbyn. A decade ago, he was handed power by hundreds of thousands of Labour members, backed by millions more around the country, to kick the Blairites out of the party. His supporters wanted a fighting opposition to austerity, NATO, and Britain's nuclear weapons. They were betrayed on all counts. Corbyn capitulated to the Labour Party's Blairite right to the point of being thrown out of its ranks, being branded as an anti-Semite. After years of his Labour leadership in which he and the trade union bureaucracies brought the class struggle to a record low, he then retired quietly to the back benches, sitting on a volcano of social discontent. For 4 years, Keir Starmer's Labour Party was given the field as the left answer to what was approaching a decade and a half of Tory rule. When Starmer came to power, with the aid of the trade union leaders who throttled a growing strike movement, the mantle of the opposition was allowed to pass to Reform. Corbyn, still promoted as the figurehead of a left-wing movement by the Socialist Workers' Party and other pseudo-left groups, refused all entreaties from the same to form his own party. While the government dutifully amplified the nationalist talking points of Reform UK, launched xenophobic campaigns, and implemented anti-migrant policies that have virtually invited Farage into office, Corbyn preached peace, love, and understanding. While the media worked to enforce a right-wing monopoly on opposition to Starmer, criticizing him for failing to spend on the military, cut welfare, and attack laws on employment and renters' rights, Corbyn tutted at a Labour leader he would not even name. When he finally launched your party, he did so only to neuter it, leading an anti-socialist witch hunt. Amid its shipwreck, the title of Britain's leading left has passed to Green Party leader Zach Polanski, An empty charlatan whose only political principle is to say what wins favor at the time. Only the Socialist Equality Party told the truth of what Corbyn was doing and its consequences, when what most workers were hearing was that his insipid semi-reformism and anti-socialist scheming was what constituted left-wing politics, many turned away. As long as this is allowed to continue, the inevitable result will be an ongoing march to the right. Thursday's results also expose the bankrupt character of the Together Alliance and all organizations which seek to subordinate politics to the slogan "Stop Reform" and the strategy of tactical voting in parliamentary alliances between the other capitalist parties. Workers know what these parties are, and they will not be persuaded to vote for them. The only way forward is the fight for a genuinely socialist party opposed to all the others, for which great opportunities are now opening up. The Socialist Equality Party treats the rise of reform deadly seriously, but we have nothing in common with the middle-class despair over the rise of the right. Starmer's refusal to plunge the country into chaos by resigning as prime minister and labor leader is about more than personal arrogance. He knows the significance of shattering the de facto two-party system, which has been a straitjacket on British politics. He knows the radicalizing effect that the consequences of the war on Iran will have. The working class is asking new political questions, which only the socialist movement can ultimately answer. It will increasingly be pitched into struggles, international in scope, which reveal the real class interests served by each political tendency. Through those experiences, workers can be won to socialist politics by a policy of intransigent opposition to all forms of capitalist inequality and oppression. The same issues are posed across Europe and internationally. The old social democratic and liberal parties are in freefall. Their nominal left alternatives, from Polanski to France's Jean-Luc Mélenchon to the German Left Party, oppose a struggle by the working class for socialism, advocating meager reformist measures. In country after country, the result is either the far right in government, such as in Italy and the Czech Republic, or leading the polls, as in France, the National Rally, Germany, the AfD, Austria, the Freedom Party, and Romania, the Alliance for the Union of Romanians. The decisive political lesson to be drawn is the urgent need to build the Socialist Equality Party, UK, the Parti de l'Égalité Socialiste, France, the Socialistische Gleichheitspartei, Germany, and new sections of the International Committee of the Fourth International. It should be fine, we hope. Trump dismisses Hanta virus threat as outbreak spreads. By Evan Blake. Asked Thursday evening about the Hanta virus outbreak that has killed 3 people, sickened at least 8 more, and dispersed dozens of potentially exposed travelers across more than a dozen countries, U.S. President Donald Trump told reporters, "It's very much, we hope, under control. It was the ship, and I think we're going to make a full report about it tomorrow. We have a lot of people, it's a lot of great people that are studying it, and it should be fine, we hope." Pressed on whether Americans should be concerned about further spread, "I hope not. I hope not. We'll do the best we can." Trump's promised full report had not materialized as of Friday evening. What had materialized was a flashback to early 2020, so acute that even the bourgeois press could not avoid the parallel. In the early weeks of what would become the COVID-19 pandemic, Trump told the public the coronavirus was very much under control, that U.S. case counts would soon be close to zero, and that the virus would go away of its own accord. More than 1.5 million Americans have since been struck down by COVID-19. Globally, more than 30 million have died, more than 400 million suffer from long COVID, and the virus continues to circulate and evolve into new variants. The same president, with even more dangerous officials around him, is once again telling the public to hope. In the past 24 hours, the Hanta virus outbreak has continued to extend beyond the MV Hondius cruise ship. Spanish health authorities announced Friday that a 32-year-old woman in Alicante had been hospitalized with mild respiratory symptoms after sitting 2 rows behind the index case's wife on the April 25th KLM flight from Johannesburg to Amsterdam. The Dutch woman was removed from that flight when her condition deteriorated and died the following day. Spain's Secretary of State for Health, Javier Padilla, told reporters that authorities were confident the Alicante patient would test negative, as had a KLM flight attendant from the same flight whose case the WHO confirmed Friday as negative. More epidemiologically significant is the new suspected case announced Friday by the UK Health Security Agency on Tristan da Cunha, the remote South Atlantic island where the Hondius stopped April 13th to 15th. The patient is described as an islander, not a Hondius passenger or crew member. If confirmed, this would be the first suspected secondary infection among a population that was not aboard the ship. Eyewitness accounts reveal that the ship's officers allowed passengers and crew to mingle freely with the islanders, despite the death of the index case 2 days earlier. The captain told passengers the morning after the death that the ship was safe. Rui Sene, a Turkish travel vlogger aboard, told AFP, "I wish we did not land there after the first casualty, because along with us, there were 100 more passengers, and they were interacting with the islanders." The Hondius is expected to arrive at the port of Granadilla, Tenerife, in the early hours of Sunday, May 10th, where it will anchor offshore and transfer passengers by small boats to a cordoned-off section of the airport. A CDC team is being dispatched to meet the 17 Americans aboard, who will be flown back on a charter aircraft fitted with a biocontainment unit and quarantined at the National Quarantine Unit in Nebraska. 6 U.S. states are monitoring previously disembarked passengers. None has yet reported symptoms, though the incubation period for hantavirus is up to 8 weeks. The operational response is being conducted by career staff at the CDC, by Spanish, Dutch, and German hospitals, and by WHO technical officers. Above them, the political leadership of the United States is silent or worse. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the longtime anti-vaccine quack, has not addressed the outbreak. Acting CDC Director Jay Bhattacharya, co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration that supplied the ideological foundation for the bipartisan Let It Rip pandemic policy, has held no press conference. The public health apparatus that once provided at least a modicum of friction against Trump's nostrums has been deliberately demolished. In a comment provided to the World Socialist website, Dr. Peter Daszak, the zoonotic disease researcher who has himself been the target of a fascistic political witch hunt culminating in the destruction of EcoHealth Alliance, situated the Trump response within the broader assault on outbreak response capacity. While the risk of further hantavirus spread is limited compared to more transmissible diseases, Daszak said, "Public health isn't just about preventing and controlling a disease spread. The fear of an outbreak is also a problem, and we can see that around the world. From the dock workers in Spain through to public health agencies in the USA where travelers have now returned home." Meanwhile, here in the USA, the Trump administration has systematically dismantled our ability to deal with outbreaks. They've put vaccine deniers and people directly opposed to outbreak containment measures like Bhattacharya and Kennedy in key positions of power. Fired thousands of NIH and CDC employees, terminated federal funding like the NIAID, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, CREID, Centers for Research in Emerging Infectious Diseases, grants, and even gone as far as arresting scientists who fought the last pandemic. The dock workers Daszak referred to are those at Santa Cruz de Tenerife, who held a protest Friday against the Spanish government's decision, taken over the objections of the regional Canary Islands president, to allow the ship to disembark its passengers in their port. Their banners read, "Workers of Tenerife Port, TPT, respect Tenerife. We are not second class." A port worker told Reuters, "The problem is not working at the harbor itself. The problem is for them to have contact with people living here on the island." Daszak's reference to the terminated CREID grants is not abstract. Scientific American reported Friday that the Centers for Research in Emerging Infectious Diseases, CREID, established in 2020 to study pathogens that jump from animals to humans, was shut down by NIH on June 5, 2025. One of the 10 centers had been running a pilot project specifically studying how the Andes strain of hantavirus, the strain now confirmed in the Hondius cluster, passes from rodents to humans. 11 months later, the same strain is being air evacuated to a biocontainment unit in Omaha. Daszak's broader scientific point exposes the falsity of reassurances from U.S. officials and the WHO. Zoonotic emerging diseases like COVID-19, hantavirus, and monkeypox, he said, are rising exponentially. They're emerging more often, spreading more quickly, making people sicker faster, and crashing our economies as they do. The right-wing response of denying this, burying our head in the sand, and worse still, demolishing our defenses against them, is as dumb as a rock and will lead to illness and death. In a separate comment, scientist Philip Markelin, who appeared in the documentary Blame and has authored a book on the origins of COVID-19, told the WSWS that the Hondius outbreak is a stark reminder of widening fractures and weaknesses in our pandemic preparedness. Public health authorities, he said, face an emerging zoonotic pathogen whose nature and transmission dynamics are at best incompletely understood. In an environment where scientific data, decision authority, and institutional trust is severely limited. Markelin then turned to the public-facing dimension. We now have a public and information environment primed to draw from COVID-19 experiences, quick and false analogies, meeting a willing and well-oiled machinery of alternative medicine grifters, influencers, and crises entrepreneurs, ready to make use of the uncertain situation by selling everything from supplements to ivermectin. The wider public, he said, is left to their own devices. The outbreak, he concluded, is an easy trial run and limited preview into our next pandemic crisis response, in which there is unfortunately not much to feel confident about. The MV Hondius cluster may yet be contained, but the institutional and scientific catastrophe surrounding it will not be. The initial response of the Trump administration and authorities internationally to the hantavirus outbreak makes clear that when the next pathogen arrives with COVID-like or greater transmissibility, and the science is unanimous that it will, nothing will be done to prevent its transmission or the avoidable deaths of tens of millions more. The World Socialist website urges workers, scientists, public health experts, and all those alarmed by the hantavirus outbreak and the broader war on science to contact us to share your experiences and thoughts on this deepening crisis. WSWS.org/contact. U.S. attacks two Iranian-flagged tankers as Trump escalates war ahead of China summit, by Andre Damon. U.S. Navy aircraft attacked two Iranian-flagged oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman on Friday as part of the U.S. naval blockade of Iran in the latest escalation of the war. F/A-18 Super Hornets launched from the aircraft carrier USS George H.W. Bush fired precision munitions into the smokestacks of the MT SeaStar-3 and MT Sevda, disabling the vessels. A third Iranian tanker, the MT Hasna, was disabled in the same way on Wednesday. The strikes followed by one day the first U.S. strikes on Iranian territory since the April 8th truce. On Thursday, U.S. forces hit Iranian military targets at Bandar Abbas and on Keshem Island after Iran fired missiles, drones, and small boats at three U.S. Navy destroyers transiting the Strait of Hormuz. Hours after Thursday's strikes, U.S. President Donald Trump issued what was widely understood as a nuclear threat against Iran. Speaking to reporters at the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool in Washington, Trump said, "You're just going to have to look at one big glow coming out of Iran, and they better sign their agreement fast." The war the United States and Israel launched on Iran on February 28th is in its 71st day. The Pentagon hit roughly 13,000 targets in 38 days of combat operations. The Iranian government has reported 81,000 civilian structures damaged, including 275 medical facilities. The Iranian Human Rights Activists News Agency has documented 3,636 Iranian deaths through April 7th, including 1,701 civilians. Israel has reported 24 killed and 7,791 wounded by Iranian missile attacks. 13 U.S. troops have been killed and more than 400 wounded. The Intercept has reported the actual toll is at least 15. At least 9 Gulf state nationals have been killed in Iranian strikes on the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Oman. The war's regional dimensions continue to expand. Israel has been bombing Lebanon throughout the ceasefire it agreed to in November 2024, with operations sharply intensifying in recent days. Israeli forces struck Beirut's southern suburbs on Wednesday, the first attack near the Lebanese capital since the ceasefire began, targeting the commander of Hezbollah's elite Radwan force in the Harat Hraik neighborhood. Israeli strikes across southern and eastern Lebanon have killed at least 13 people in recent days. Israeli jets struck Beirut at 3 a.m. local time, and the Israeli military issued evacuation orders for civilians across more than 50 villages in southern Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley. The escalation comes a week before Trump is to meet Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing on May 14th. The summit will take place as the United States enforces what Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has called an ironclad naval blockade running from the Gulf of Oman to the open oceans, a posture that places effective restrictions on Chinese flag shipping calling at Iranian ports and on the seaborne oil trade that supplies the Chinese economy. The blockade now holds an estimated 70 tankers in custody with a combined capacity of 166 million barrels, valued at more than $13 billion. China sources approximately a third of its crude oil through the Strait of Hormuz and receives 37.7% of all oil that passes through the choke point, more than any other country. China is the largest buyer of Iranian oil, taking more than 80% of Iran's seaborne exports in 2025. Iranian crude accounted for roughly 12% of China's total imported crude last year. Hegseth has called the Iranian blockade a gift to the world and said the United States will maintain it as long as it takes. The United States has failed to achieve its stated objectives of crippling the Iranian military and overthrowing its government. U.S. intelligence assessments have concluded that the war has produced limited new damage to Iran's nuclear program. Iran's stockpile of approximately 440 kilograms of highly enriched uranium, enough for an estimated 10 weapons, remains intact in deeply buried sites that U.S. munitions cannot penetrate. Roughly half of Iran's pre-war conventional missile force has survived. The Iranian government has not been dislodged, and Iran continues to control the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has inflicted serious damage on U.S. assets across the region. 16 U.S. bases have taken Iranian fire since the war began. The Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar lost a $1 billion radar. Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia was struck on March 27, wounding 12 U.S. soldiers and destroying an AWACS aircraft. The 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain was hit on the war's first day. Nearly half of U.S. Patriot interceptor stocks have been expended, and more than half of THAAD interceptor stocks. Replacement timelines are 3 to 4 years. The depth of the strategic crisis was underscored by a Reuters report published Thursday by Idris Ali, Aaron Banco, and Haydam Mayer that the Central Intelligence Agency has assessed Iran can withstand the U.S. blockade for approximately 4 more months. The cost of the war is also soaring far beyond the Pentagon's official numbers. In a New York Times op-ed published Friday, Hegseth says this war has cost $25 billion. I tallied up the true amount. University of Michigan economist Justin Wolfers wrote, "The best any economist can do right now is get the order of magnitude right, and my math suggests the Iran war will cost hundreds of billions of dollars and very possibly trillions." Wolfers' calculation includes munitions, ship and aircraft losses, the readiness backlog at Patriot and THAAD plants, the carrier deployment surge across CENTCOM, and the macroeconomic damage to the U.S. economy from the energy shock and consumer price spike. In the face of this debacle, significant sections of the U.S. ruling class are demanding a military escalation by Trump. The Wall Street Journal editorial board, in a piece headlined "Iran Tests Trump's Will to Fight," wrote that, "By signaling a deep reluctance to restart major military operations, he encouraged the Iranians to hold out for better terms. By keeping the ceasefire on life support even now, Mr. Trump sends the same message. But rather than wait for Iran, the U.S. could at least resume guiding commercial ships out of the strait. The regime needs to know it is losing its leverage. Mark Thiessen, in a Washington Post op-ed published Thursday, Trump risks snatching defeat from the jaws of victory in Iran, called for a sweeping escalation. So what should Trump do? Simple. Finish what he started, Thiessen wrote. Resume a Project Freedom. If Iran fires at the U.S. or threatens the energy infrastructure of our Gulf allies again, retaliate by striking Iran's energy infrastructure on Karg Island, through which over 90% of Iran's oil passes. Then give Israel the green light to resume combat operations, striking leadership, weapons, and energy targets across Iran. If Iran still won't capitulate, Trump can launch a final barrage of strikes and then begin covert operations to arm the Iranian people to overthrow the regime. A further escalation of military violence, far from resolving the crisis facing the Trump administration, would only deepen it.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.